If everyone would please take their seats, please. We are going to call the Property Tax and Local Sales Tax Division meeting to order. And I know members will be coming as they finish lunch and so forth, but my intent today here, and earlier during the Tax Committee, we heard all sorts of, we heard a lot about the reduction in the corporate franchise tax. We will not be dealing with that. We are dealing only with property tax issues. And the way I would like this to work is that if Commissioner Innes would come forward, and we will go over each of the areas according to this handout that was being used earlier today. I think we would start with page 14 in this one, if that would be okay. And members, if you have questions as Commissioner Innes goes over each of the areas, please, that's the time to do it. My intent also is to, depending on how long this goes, but I'd like to, at a minimum, leave 30 minutes for testimony from various groups and individuals and so forth. So I'm going to try to at least leave 30 minutes. That's why we'll have about an hour to go over this portion. And so again, members, if you have any questions or that, please bring those up. And Commissioner, thank you so much for being here and for your work on behalf of the state. I must say, because you know, at the end of last year, after everything was done, we kind of all part our ways. But I, on a personal note, I thoroughly enjoyed working with you and the revenue staff as we were in conference committee, and it's to be late nights and all of that. And I really thought what finally came together, other than a few things we've got to maybe correct yet, was a very strong tax bill. So I do appreciate your efforts in all of that.
And Chairman, I share the same sentiment. It was a lot of heavy lifting in that conference committee, and it was the wee hours of the morning, but it's all in all, the final product was a good one.
So, thank you. Well, Commissioner, I'm going to let you start. And again, members, we're on page 14 of this. Is this what you're going off of?
I think that's the easiest.
Yeah, I thought that too as I look forward.
And I know that your committee handed out, on the previous committee, we've handed out the House Tax and Aid spreadsheet, which I think is very illustrative as well. I think it really helped kind of track the reductions.
So we do have that. So, Commissioner, please begin.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes with the Department of Revenue. And as the chairman said, I'll start on page 14, and that is the change item regarding the county program aid. And maybe I'll just start. We structured the county program aid and the LGA cuts and the market value credits in a manner that's similar to what we did in 2003. And it's to fresh people's memory, we did a cut in that year, but we backloaded the cut in the second year in order to allow communities to have a little more time to adjust their budgets, understanding that the budgets had already been set, and so we backloaded the cut. We capped, as a percent of levy plus aid, the maximum amount of the cut it could be in 2003. We've done the same thing this year. So we tried to adopt the same structure that passed in 2003 this year. So people are somewhat familiar with the overall structure. There are a few wrinkles, and I'll talk about those. But the county program aid is the first one on page 14. And this is where there is a wrinkle relative to what we did in 2003. The county program aid cut, as you can see from your spreadsheet, represents, for the biennium, represents about a 27% cut in the CPA appropriation. That is capped for pay 2009 at 1.53%, and then at pay 2010 at 2.8%. And that assumes that the counties participate in this consolidation of health and human services, and they buy back a portion of their cut. So there's a built-in incentive in the budget to participate in these consolidation of health and human services. And I think now Deputy Commissioner Wilkin is here. If there's questions about that part, it's really a DHS, more of a DHS issue. We're confident that the benchmarks that need to be satisfied to buy back the aid are very attainable. For example, in November, the counties would have to indicate an intent to participate in the consolidation effort. And then in June of 2010, they need to come forward with a county resolution indicating they're still moving forward on that. And then the following year, they're required to have a joint powers agreement in place and submitted with the Department of Health and Human Services. And if they meet those benchmarks along the way, they, as you can see on page 14, they buy back a portion of the county program aid cut. So the numbers I talked about, the cap and the percent, are assuming that they all go forward and meet the requirements on the consolidation side.
Excuse me, Commissioner, Representative Wachler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, I have not seen the detail on this proposal, so I don't know what the details are and how it works and how it works for what is considered an efficient size and what those 15 groupings would be. Hennepin County has 30% of the caseload of the state. I hope you don't ask them to get bigger. But I do think this is actually more a tax policy issue here than it is a human service issue. And that I can't remember, but I'm asking you or our staff, if there's any other time in which we've used a property tax relief mechanism to really be a mandate or a direction on how you deliver services. And I'm thinking of, you know, the school districts, we used to have 436 and now we're down to 300 and some, but that was all done voluntarily because of their own recognitions of, you know, needs to work together. We've never, as far as I know, forced cities who could do shared services to do shared services. And I'd like to know if we've ever used this part of the budget to, you know, force a service system model. It's really a unique precedent that I'm not sure we want to go into.
I'm seeing kind of a shaking of heads. I do know with local government aid, there was a local performance aid back in the late 1990s, which asked cities to come up with a performance measurement and improvement plan. And I remember as mayor, you had to have a resolution at a city council meeting saying you were doing this. And the dollars you received, which was about a dollar per capita, maybe a little bit less, had to be used to also reduce taxes by that same amount, but you could use it to be part of that plan. So Commissioner, I don't know if you can remember any other time that's either dealing with local government aid or county program aid where you're kind of setting some leverage on doing something. And
Chairman, Representative Laffa, I'm not familiar with any precedent along these particular lines. I would defer to Pat Dalton. She has a photo memory on these kind of things. So I'm sure if it ever has been a precedent, she'd be aware of it, but I'm not aware of a precedent. But I think it does speak to the environment we're in now, where the status quo, sending out the aid on the same formula, with the same expectations, is probably not the best way of doing business going forward. And I think even our initial conversations with the county, they had some, you know, a lot of questions about the proposal, but they didn't dismiss it out of hand either. I think they understand that there's a real need to do some of this consolidation. Sometimes an incentive is required to kind of maybe push people over the finish line. So that was the philosophy behind why we went down this road. And it's going to be coupled with a serious effort to do some mandate relief. And so we're working with the counties, potentially the cities also, to do something in the way of mandate relief. We think this, you know, is kind of related to that and trying to change the incentives.
Ms. Dalton's sister said you had photographic memory, although you only go way back instead of some go way, way back.
I only go back to 1987.
Okay.
but the only thing that we've ever, the only other time that I can actually think where we tied aid to requiring local governments to do something was when we basically instituted the non-optional local option sales tax. And if a county did not impose the half-cent sales tax, not only did the county lose its aid, but all the local governments located within the county lost their aid. So needless to say, all the counties did participate in part of the half-cent sales tax.
Representative Wapler, anything more on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, I do think even that's different because that was a revenue policy of what we thought should be the revenue streams going into the state and local government. And this is really about a service system delivery design. And even though I know something about county services, I don't know about it in your part of the state or other members' parts of the state, and I don't know if this is the best committee to be weighing in on what is the perfect design system, or if this is the right revenue stream to use, even if you wanted to create carrots and sticks, because this county program aid, as I recall, replaced family preservation aid. It replaced other aids that were for direct specific services. And in an earlier budget crisis, they decide, you know, it's the old, oh, well, we'll combine it all and call it a block grant, and it'll be efficient money, and then we'll slice it. And this is sort of the same deal where we're, you know, the caseloads have not gone down, the service expectations have not gone down in terms of the property tax demands for filling the holes, whether it's in the Health and Human Services Committee or it's in Michael Tamar and Joe Mullery's committee. And so it does feel to me like this is a precedent that I quite honestly am not comfortable with, because otherwise this committee is going to have to start weighing in on the jurisdiction of a lot of committees.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Chairman, Representative Officer, I concur. I think that this should not be exclusively within the purview of the tax committee. I think the Health and Human Services legislators should weigh in on this, because I'm not an expert on health and human services delivery system, you know. So I think we need to get the input from the other committees, and I'm sure this bill, or this portion of the bill, would probably travel to those committees, I'd expect, just because this mechanism is such an important part of the proposal. I know it's a work in progress, so I think the final touches are being made at Department of Health and Human Services, and so you'll see actual language, I think, within the next week.
Cool. Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
So that essentially is the county program aid reductions. I will go now to page 15. We're talking about the local government aid reductions involving cities. And as you can see from the spreadsheet, the local government aid is about a 23% reduction for the biennium. Once again, the cut is backloaded in the second year. In pay 09, the percentage cut is 14.8%. That represents about 5.05% of levy plus aid. In pay 2010, the cut is about 31% and represents about over 10.5% of levy plus aid. And once again, that's structured in a very similar manner to what we did in 03.
Commissioner, and Ms. Dalton, just for everyone's information, if it's correct, it's kind of how it's probably been done in the past, but for payable 09 and payable 10, you're just kind of scaling back, not really using the formula, just scaling back based upon levy plus aid. But in 2011, you would go back to the normal formula, that would be a permanent lower level of LGA appropriation. Am I reading that correctly? So, initially in 09 and 10, they're kind of working backwards. They're looking at levy plus aid and making cuts proportional rather than using the formula, and then saying we're just going to scale back on the formula or need factor or whatever that might be.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding from discussions with the Department of Revenue is that they're looking at certified 2009 aid as a baseline.
Right.
They're making those cuts off of 2009 levy plus aid in both pay 09 and pay 010. Pay 10. I'll get used to saying that. And then beginning in 11, they will be using the formula to distribute the lower level of appropriation.
Okay.
So the formula will start going back into effect beginning in pay 11.
Okay. Anything else on local government aid?
And I think that,
Commissioner, you know, I'm just looking at that, and I think, of course, local government aid is going to be a big issue. And I very much respect what the governor has put out here. I mean, he's putting out what he thinks are his priorities and the best way to balance the budget. And so, actually, I don't even know right now to even talk levels is pertinent, because we're going to probably see a bigger deficit later on. But one of the things I kind of wanted to look through as I looked at the governor's budget was just a couple things. And one is it fair, which means geographically balanced? And I don't know if you can do it necessarily and make it truly geographically balanced. And what I'm looking at is with LGA, that the assumption is that you have cities with this level of property wealth, and you have some with this property wealth. And to get the same amount of service, this community would have to raise its taxes quite a bit more. There'd be a much heavier burden. So if you say that, LGA is kind of a great equalizer. So now we're all here now on the even keel. Once LGA is applied, we're on even keel, and we're basically trying to provide the same service at the same cost. How can you try to create an equal burden if you only then cut one back? Now you can say, well, this one only gets the LGA, but if the assumption is that it's kind of an equalizer, that get to that point, then you still have to kind of cut them together. It's like Guy Rogers back in March of 1962, when he said he was bragging about how he and Wilt Chamberlain had combined for 111 points that one night. And didn't exactly say that Wilt Chamberlain had scored 100 on that night. But at any rate, you know, they all shared the burden, so to speak, of that victory, but won a little bit more. And I know on page 16, when you talk about the homestead market value credits, you, the cities that don't get LGA get cut. Then you lose some of the market value homestead credits to try to share the burden. And I understand that. But as the governor, and you kind of thought this through, I mean, is that a concern that, and it's maybe just the inherent system, that you have LGA and you haven't got a lot of other, you got market value homestead credits, but even if you cut all of that, most of the cities are only going to see a 1% or 2% in the second year, levy plus aid reduction, where most of the other ones are about 10.5%. So my concern is disparity among two different parts of the state, and of course, if you've got that, you're going to have a weaker state overall. I mean, what's the governor's thoughts on that, or as you kind of look at this dilemma?
Chairman, it's a good question. We spent a lot of time looking at the geographical impacts of the LGA cuts, you know, on top of the unallotment, and we ran different runs. So it's certainly a concern, but to your point, I think you're right. It's somewhat inherent to the system in how we do LGA. And so we thought the most equitable way of doing it was in the levy plus aid, unlike the proposal we came with for a couple of years ago. But so the levy plus aid proposal, and then, you know, the market value credit is a skin in the game for those communities that don't have either LGA or a large proportion of LGA, to try to spread, I guess you would say, the pain around to the greatest extent possible. But the reality is, you're right, among those communities, like if you take in a diner, gets no LGA and very minimal amount of market value credit, I think they're at, you know, I'm not sure they're at 1% of levy plus aid. But I guess the next question is, what do you take when you've taken everything they got? And there really is another alternative. So we did the best we could to try to cap the impacts based on levy plus aid, take the market value credit for those communities that aren't relying on LGA, and try to do our best we could to try to spread the cuts around to as many jurisdictions as possible.
You know, Commissioner, I hear your goal. You were talking earlier in tax committee about with the franchise or the corporate income tax, you know, trying to be competitive with other states, and I understand that. And, you know, it used to be, I kind of think, at least along the border, that, and I know Representative Lanning can attest to this, that one of the advantages we had, like with our border state, North Dakota, were property taxes, a lower property tax. But now North Dakota, with their surpluses, with all the oil, they've actually got a plan out there to reduce property taxes by $300 million, which would be, we'd lose that advantage along the border. And today in local government, Taylor Falls had a request to become a border city along Wisconsin. And they showed some statistics that show now that Wisconsin has lower property taxes in some of their businesses. And I'm wondering, is the governor concerned? I mean, I'm concerned about the competitiveness now with property taxes along the border, and that was one area where we thought we had an advantage. Do you see that as a potential concern also when you're looking at competitiveness in the economy?
Yeah. Well, Chairman, it's certainly a concern. We've talked about property taxes, a statewide property tax, even local property taxes. Part of the governor's impetus for the levy limits was to try to put a cap on property taxes, not just for homeowners, but for all types of business. To provide some level of security that property taxes aren't going to escalate substantially. But the property tax is a tough one to get your head around because there's so many local variations based on spending decisions, based on tax base, based on, you know, tax capacity. But it's certainly a concern. And I know in those border communities, it's a more pronounced concern because the ability to just go to Fargo is a real possibility. And so those are definitely concerns. Beyond that, you know, I don't have a proposal to put in front of you that says here's our remedy to that concern, but it certainly is.
Representative Hendrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just feel like I need to say this, and I don't know that I offer any suggestions or anything, but I really have to comment on this, the LGA piece of this. And it's right in the recommendation where it, you state that the governor just feels so strongly that that the local units of government must share the burden of solving the current budget problem. And I don't think that there's anybody that could disagree with this, but I do think that there are some people, including myself, that say, have our cities and local units of government taken more than their share of the burden of the volatile economy that we've been facing in the last 5 years? You know, they took a hit in 2003 or 2004, 2008, and now 2009 again. And I guess I really feel like they've been treated unfairly. I think that we are treating them like they have been doing something wrong all along. And I, at least when I check in with my constituents, they really believe that our local cities manage their money well and that they do get a very good value for the dollars that they pay. And so I get so frustrated that we just have to keep pounding on them. And, you know, then the other thing that I haven't had the chance to review this whole document, but then I have paged forward enough. It doesn't look like he does anything with levy limits, modifying them in response to our treatment of the cities. Is that true?
That is true, Chairman, a representative. That is true. There's no change to the levy limits in the governor's proposal. That is correct. But to that point, I think there was some discussion that potentially levy limits should be tighter because of these LGA reductions. Because in 2003, when we did the LGA reductions, we only allowed 60% levy back of the last LGA. Under the governor's levy limits, there would be full levy back of the 2010 cut and beyond allotment under the special levy. So there's the potential for local units government, even under the levy limit proposal, to recoup a large portion of the LGA they've lost. So, I mean, there was some legitimate discussion about maybe potentially tightening up because we don't want a big snapback on the property taxes. But under the levy limits that were passed last year, there would be an opportunity for levy plus aid levy limits. So there'd be an opportunity for them, when they're certifying levies this fall, to certify higher levy and recoup the lost aid. To your point about it feels as if it's a penalty or a punishment or an indictment of cities, and I just want to state that that's not the case at all. I mean, we are looking at a huge budget deficit. And when we sat down and started making very difficult decisions about where to cut, we went through all these discussions. And the governor is sensitive to the LGA and county program aid reductions. There's a lot of political heat that goes with making those reductions, undoubtedly. But is that appropriation a higher priority than higher ed? Is it a higher priority than K-12? Is it a higher priority in all instances than health human services? Is it a higher priority than economic development programs? Is it a higher priority? Well, we went through the whole laundry list. And I think at the end of the day, it's still a priority, but there's other things that are as high priority, it's not a higher priority. So in no way is it an indictment of the cities are doing the wrong thing, they're not behaving fiscally prudently, we're going to cut their LJ. That was not part of the discussion at all. It's about where we're going to set our priorities. And, you know, some people thought we should have cut more, some people thought we cut too much. I mean, it's all over the ballpark. But the reality is we made some very tough decisions and tried to itemize the priorities as best we could, considering the situation we're in, and knowing full well, based on all the economic data that's coming in, that it's going to be markedly worse when the February forecast comes up. So that's, you know, it certainly is not an indictment of local government at all.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. One, you brought up the idea of the issue of the border communities and property taxes in North Dakota. And actually, I think I got a good idea. We should put up some oil rigs in Moorhead and then just drill sideways into North Dakota and take the oil out. I think maybe we could do something with work on that, Representative Lanning, and steal North Dakota's oil. A word on Commissioner Inez. Sorry, Commissioner. The market value of homestead credit and LGA limitations, what was the cap on the cut for 2010? No, I'm saying 2010. 2010 and 2011. What was it? I probably in here somewhere.
Here it is. Chairman, Representative Grasswell. For cities, in pay 2009, this year, the cap is 5.05% of levy plus aid. And then in subsequent year, pay 2010, it is 10.55%.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, it comes as no surprise to you that I've never liked levy limits and have argued against them repeatedly. And as I've always said, that it's more difficult to argue against them when you have an increase in aid. Because the aid, additional aid is given to help give some relief to the property taxes on the local level. But when you have cuts in aid, I think it's very hard to justify the continuation of levy limits under those circumstances. I think local units of government need to be given the kind of flexibility that they would have, and they have to be accountable to their local citizenry, and if they raise taxes beyond what people like, they'll suffer the consequences. So I know that comes as no surprise to you, because we've had many conversations about that over time. But the other thing I would say is that it strikes me that the proposal on aid, local aid reductions are disproportionate to some of the other cuts in the governor's budget. And in the end, my view is we have to do better and be more proportional in the reductions that we look at. And that'll be a part of our discussion as we go forward. And I appreciate very much the work that you do, and sometimes we are on different wavelengths.
Even Commissioner Representative Lanning, thank you. You know, we have 1 year of experience with the levy limits that passed last year. We have 1 year of experience now, and I think what we passed was such a reasonable compromise between protecting taxpayers and also providing enough levy authority for local units of government to really, you know, fund their core services. And even with the levy limit in place, you know, property taxes are scheduled to go up 6.5%. So even with the levy limit in place, we're still seeing, you know, levy increases that are twice the rate of inflation, which I think the taxpayer is a substantial increase. So in light of that, I think the levy limits have played their role. I think they've struck a reasonable balance. I think we worked very closely in the conference committee to make sure we have the right special levies in place to accommodate certain communities with unique challenges, like the foreclosure special levy and the police and fire special levy and some of these other things. So I don't think it can be argued that these are draconian, you didn't represent it, but these are draconian levy limits that are really, you know, suffocating local units of government's ability to raise the necessary revenue. And there's always the ultimate default, that if you have a compelling revenue need that you want to meet, you can always take it to your voters and pass a referendum and go to any amount above the levy limit you want. That's always kind of the default. If you have a compelling need, and you can sell that to the voters. So I know we have just a philosophical disagreement about levy limits and their proper role, but I think these are reasonable as far as levy limits go.
Well, we're talking levy limits. Ms. Dalton, you just had a little bit on what can be levied back and what can't and so forth, if you could elaborate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's a special levy for unallotments, so all of the 2008 unallotments could be levied back by counties and cities. Because of how levy limits work, all of the 2010 aid cuts could be levied back automatically. It would be built into the levy limit. However, none of the pay 2009 aid cut could be levied back.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Wampler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, as I look at this, you know, we look at it from a number of different hats, and one of the most important hats we wear is, what is this going to do to the small businesses and the homeowners that we represent? And in a budget that's this challenged in so many places, it's hard to kind of layer down the impacts and the pressures on both local governments and that property taxpayer. And I'm wondering if it might be possible for you to work with the Commissioner of Finance and the other agencies and give us a layer of sort of the local impact of the governor's budget, plus and minus, on local governments, city, counties, townships, schools. It's maybe a little cleaner because they tend to have their own budget, but I'm thinking of, you know, funds that would, you know, I don't know if the DNR PILT payments, if there's changes in DNR land acquisition or other policies that would impact that for the revenue stream into local government. For counties, it would be what's happening in the corrections and public safety and health and human service areas. For cities, there may be other revenue streams that come through other committees. I know that the library funding comes through education, and that's often a city function. But if we could have that together, because I think that's how ultimately that taxpayer, whether it's a business owner or if an individual is going to have to experience it, and it's only after we see the impact of those layered cuts and all the different pieces of the budget that we can really even have a coherent assessment about levy limits or aid levels or anything else. And so if I don't know if one of those has ever been compared before, but that would be really helpful to me.
Thank you. Anything else on local government aid before we move on? Representative Blaney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, has there ever been any thought about different levy limits or having limits or no limits to different kind of city situations? I mean, when you have a city that has no LGA, very little, if any, market value credit, levy limit there may be have a whole different consequence than a levy limit for a city that gets huge reductions in aid and has to make up somehow, has to cut obviously, but also tries to keep some things going by increasing the levy.
Commissioner, Chairman, Representative Lanning, there hasn't been any recent discussion of an alternative on the levy limit. I will say this, there's been people who approach that and say, well, does it make any sense to put a levy limit on Edina because they don't get any LGA, so why even a levy limit? Why are you trying to micromanage that local unit of the government? I think our response has always been, this is about protecting taxpayers. And it doesn't matter if you live in a high LGA dependent city or a low LGA dependent city, this is really about providing a layer of protection to the taxpayer. That's the primary motivation. It's not to punish LGA dependent cities and say we want you to not raise your levy because you're getting this money. It's really about protecting the taxpayers, no matter where they reside or no matter what jurisdiction they're in. And so we've had an approach in the past. If you don't get any state aid, then why are we micromanaging? But it's really a larger. The answer really is about protecting taxpayers.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I was arguing the opposite. I was saying that maybe it makes sense. The levy limit makes sense in a community that has a substantial tax base, gets no LGA, gets very little, if any, market value credit. But when you have a city that depends heavily on local government aid, they get big cuts. Why not let them be able, if their citizens agree to it and accept it, why not let them raise some levy to make up some of what has been cut? That's my question or point.
Commissioner,
Chairman, Representative Lanning, under the levy limits that passed last year, they would have that option. They would have the option to raise their levy as much as they wanted to if the taxpayers of that jurisdiction voted affirmatively to vote for tax increase beyond the levy limit. So I think that, to me, that is the ultimate default of representative democracy. We force schools to pass referendums, operating referendums, capital referendums. I don't think it's unreasonable to also expect cities, if they reach a certain threshold, or counties, to also go to their voters to increase their referendum, increase their levy.
Very good, thank you. We're going to Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you. The last couple of comments have just sparked a comparison that I just need to bring out. Since this is the Property Tax Committee, it's not totally irrelevant. But we talk about...
Everything's relevant in the Property Tax Division, Representative Dietrich.
We've talked about priorities, and property taxes are going to go up. And the ability to raise property taxes with voter approval and not. And so maybe I'm just jumping the gun and prioritizing too quickly. But, you know, we just came from education finance yesterday, and we heard, you know, the governor's proposal for QCOMP. And that gives the ability for a school district to raise a levy for his pay-for-performance proposal, QCOMP. And so that is a new program. I shouldn't say new. It's been implemented in a handful of districts throughout the state. And so when I see the willingness to raise property taxes without a vote on one hand, and then treating the cities and the counties like this, and as I said before, with multiple years of cuts and taking, I think, their fair share of the burden of our fiscal condition. So I just have to point that out. It just seems a little opposing here in the thought process for me, or I just haven't totally prioritized it yet myself.
Thank you. Representative Bruno.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to that point, and to my good friend and colleague, Representative Dietrich.
Remember, I get your vote.
Yes. actually, if you pull it down further, and it will fit with the QSAM proposal, the governor, you know, for every dollar of local levy authority that he gives, he also provides roughly about $2 in state aid. So if we look at it from the overall context of that principle and comparing it to the levy that's being offered at the city level, they do have a substantial amount of authority to levy without voter approval in conjunction with that aid as a percentage of their overall budget. So I think they're very consistent if we take a step back and look at QCOP and not just at the LGA cuts, but a total assistance from the state in the form of the homestead credit and LGA. So just wanted to chime in with that.
Thank you. We're going to move to page 16, Commissioner. That's homestead market value credit.
Chairman, thank you very much. And page 16 is the reduction of residential homestead market value credit reimbursement. And there is precedent for this. We've done this a couple different occasions. And it's really, like we've already talked about, it's a way to kind of make sure everybody has some skin in the game as far as these budget recommendations. Page 17 is the agricultural market value credit reimbursement. And I want to take this moment to flag an error that we have made in our initial proposal, and we're going to remedy it in the February forecast to come out with a supplemental budget. And as you all know, in the city and county aid reductions, we cap those at 5.05% in the first year and 10.5% in the second year for cities. We neglected to do that for our townships. And so that was brought to our attention by some good staff work. And so we are going to come back in February when our budget comes out, and we will remedy that. We haven't decided what the cap's going to be at, but I would expect it's not going to be higher than 10%, it may be lower. But we found out there's about 30% of the townships under these cuts that would experience a reduction greater than 10% of the levy plus aid.
Thank you so much.
That was not our intent.
Thanks. I had totaled up the market value credits, cuts, and so forth, and that was my question. If you knew what percentage of levy plus aid that was for townships. So
we will have a proposal in March, February that will treat them in a comparable manner to the cities and the counties.
Okay. Anything on the homestead or agricultural market value credit? Which I have to tell you, as I talk to members around this table, that is one issue that came up over and over again is this program. So I think it may be one we even look at closer as we move on is this program. Very good. Commissioner, if you would continue, please.
Yes, on page 18 is a change to the renter's credit. This is an issue that has been visited in this committee on previous occasions. And right now, it is assumed that the purpose for the renter's credit, property taxes are 19% of rent. But the presumption has been in place for a number of years. We did a study back in 2005 in a survey that indicated that was over-reimbursing renters for the impact of the property tax. And the main reason for that is that we did a major property tax reform in 2001, and we didn't adjust the percent of rent paid to something lower, even though rental properties got a substantial reduction in their property taxes. So we never adjusted, recalibrated the renter's credit. We did a study in 2005, and it indicates that 15%, or even in some circumstances, something less than that, is the appropriate percent of rent paid. And we're recommending to make that change. I think what's happened to this program that it's morphed into not only a property tax relief program, but also a rent subsidy. And if the legislature wants to do a rent subsidy, that may be a legitimate policy, but they could bifurcate it from this and make this be what it was intended to be, which was a property tax relief program. So we're recommending that the percent of rent paid be reduced from 19% to 15%.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ines, is there any studies of disparity across the state as to the percentage of rent that is basically property tax? In other words, this is an average statewide, you say.
Right.
Is there a study of the distinction by cities or parts of cities or...
Chairman, I'm Representative Mulley, that yes, there is. In fact, the 2005 study that we did, it was actually, there were three surveys done that we relied on to coming to a 15% as the appropriate percent of rent paid. One study was a revenue, Department of Revenue study, one was an American Community Survey, and one was an MHFA study. And they did look at variations in geography as far as what the appropriate percent of rent paid is. And in Minneapolis, it's higher than 15% under one of the studies that came back. That hit it at almost 17% on one study, 13.3% on another study, and 11.5%. Non-metro, as you would have guessed, probably significantly lower than that. The non-metro average was 12.3, 11.7, and 7.3. But I think the important point, there may be some losers as I go into 15%. There may be some renters in Minneapolis that, but I think when you're trying to make a statewide policy on something like this, you try to do the best you can to hit the mark. And our best guess right now is that 15% is probably the appropriate percent in order to make this,
Representative Mulry.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of getting sick of the losers of Minneapolis, on Health and Human Services, the governor's proposals to hit. Now I learned rental credit. I learned just the other day the LGA were getting hit more. So at some point, I'd like to not have Minneapolis be the loser under every proposal coming out of the governor's office.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I think if we're going to look at changing this program, then maybe we have to go back to reality. And it's a hassle for landlords. But at one point in time, landlords had to actually put their actual property tax payments and their actual rents and calculate a building-specific rent. And it was much fairer because your own study that you shared us last year showed that there was a big difference between large apartment buildings and small buildings and single-family homes that are rented. There's real inequities when you pick a number. One size fit all doesn't really fit anybody. And it ends up, I don't think our tax system should create so many winners and losers. The one advantage of a uniform percentage, and we would need, if we went to reality, we'd have to figure out an adjustment, is it did stop punishing a tenant who happened to move into an owner-occupied duplex or triplex because they actually were paying the same rent probably as the two-bedroom down the block, but because the owner lived downstairs rather than another tenant, they actually got less of a credit. Even though they had no say over who was the owner. And so, I mean, we would have to make some adjustment for that, but I think that actually was a much fairer system, and it didn't create winners and losers. It was actually related to the actual assessment on that property, and it would reflect the real contribution towards taxes.
Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I concur with you. It's by far the most accurate way of distributing the renter's credit. Because there are wide variations between metro, non-metro, single, duplexes versus multi-units. It ranges everywhere from, 17.6% to 10%. So the wide variation. You think the primary reason for going for presumed percent of rent paid, I'm sure, was administrative, ease of administration, ease for the landlord, other things like that. But there's a compelling argument to do exactly what you said, to go back to an actual percent of actual rent paid. And we should have that discussion.
And Commissioner, I do think this is an area we really need to research a little bit. And in exactly what Representative Loeffler, you're saying about the different types, whether or not it's a duplex or whatever that might be. In the 2001 tax bill, of course, there was some major reforms. And I just looked at the simulations. And the class rate, for example, in regular apartments went from 2.4 in 01 to an 02 to 1.8, now they're at 1.25, and low income went from 1.0 to 0.9, now 0.75, so there was quite a bit. So I looked at the actual taxes paid, and if you look at the regular apartments, statewide, in 01, $259 million were paid, and in 08, now it's $260. So you certainly could, there's been no change, and yet rent has gone up, so it's just thinking the percentage has gone down of the property tax equal in with those. But then, as you mentioned, if you go to residential non-homestead, let's say one unit, that's gone from $104 million in tax in 01 to $326 in 08, tripled. And residential non-homestead two to three units from 65 to 130 has doubled. So that's why, and I think, I think we're all trying to maybe look at this, a one-size-fits-all, even though simpler creates more unfairness, and we know that in the tax system. Anytime you try to make it simpler for people, it's not as fair. I do think it's something, and I know from 83 to about 95 or 97 or something like that, to 97 it was right just on the property taxes paid, and that'd be the most accurate. I have one question, though, I'd like to ask you more of a general thing regarding this, is that when you look at the suits index, the renter's PTR is the highest in progressivity at 0.904. And on the other side of the coin, the rental housing property tax with a regressivity of minus 0.35 is the third most regressive behind cigarettes and gambling. So what we're doing is a $50 million shift and taking away from one of the most progressives and raising one of the most regressives. I guess kind of a general question is that the governor looks at not just property taxes, but looks at the tax system overall. Is that part of the discussion as you look at things? Does this make it more progressive, more regressive, so forth? I guess just a general policy question there, because this, and I think we really have to look at this, but there's no doubt, I mean, I don't have to know statistics after looking at this, that this would make the system more regressive, ever how much, some more regressive. So.
Chairman, it's a great question. It's one we always consider when we're talking about these tax policy changes, and the governor is always asking about, he knows more about the suits index than I think he ever thought he would, but we do talk at length about the incidents. I mean, I think a lot of that was the byproduct of the discussions you guys have had, both in this committee and the full tax committee, about the incident study. And we have another one coming out in March. I'm sure we'll have another very robust discussion about the incidents of our tax system. But anytime we're making a tax change, we try to look at it through, you know, the prism of a systemic, the whole system. And we don't want to get too out of line in any one area. There's other ways to address the regressivity of apartment taxes. You can do it with class rate adjustments. You can do it with other things. That's an issue. I think this program, I think we concur on this, it needs to be looked at and maybe revisited and find a more equitable way of delivering this benefit. But there are other ways we can try to address, you know, the regressivity of apartment taxes if that's a concern for the committee. But we do. It's a long-winded way of saying we do take into account the incident.
And, of course, I had to say that with Representative Winchevsky here. She's missed progressivity over there, so she had to mention that. Other comments here on the renter's credit? Okay, sir? I'm sorry, Representative Lanny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, is there anything in the proposal to adjust any of the income limits for which people qualify for renter's credit? Or is there no change in this proposal?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Representative Lanning, there's no change in any of the qualifications for the PTR. No change. As you know, Representative, the governor has always showed a preference for property tax relief that goes directly to individuals, and his budget reflects that philosophical priority of his. There's no change in the PTR program, at least the Homesteader approved PTR program. The increases that passed last year are untouched, and the eligibility limits that we increased are untouched in this budget.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. We've got about 10 minutes left before I want for sure people have an opportunity to speak. So we're going to skip political contribution refund and move to more property tax related items. Or would you like to overrule that,
Chairman,
Commissioner?
That's my favorite component.
We're going to keep on the property tax today for the sake of time. I'm sure this will be debated later on. But the sustainable force.
Chairman, thank you. This change item recommends capping the amount for any individual taxpayer can get from the Sustainable Forest Investment Act. And this is a program that's been in place a number of years that provides an incentive for property owners to keep their property forested. In exchange for that, they get $8.61, most recently $8.61 payment per acre. And this cap of $100,000, and no property owner will get more than $100,000 under this program, would only impact four taxpayers. So it's the larger taxpayers, larger property owners. My understanding is the original intent of this program was to incent small property owners to preserve their land and keep it forested. These larger property owners, it could be argued, maybe don't need as strong an incentive. But we thought it made some sense, considering the budget constraints we have, to cap it. I think there's over 1,000 people, 1,013 enrolled in the program. and only the four largest would see an adverse impact from this recommendation.
And Commissioner, I think as we look at the budget, this is one of the faster growing areas, growing literally, with sports areas of the budget. We got a slow group here today, but I mean, back in 05, there was only about a $2 million appropriation, and now it's up to $6, $7, or $8. It's going to be something like that. So.
I think you're right, Sean. I think it's going to be $16 million for the biennium.
For the biennium, yeah. Thank you. Now, next one then, Tac Night State Aid.
Yep, this is an appropriation that's been in place since 2001, and it's unique in that it's calculated as the 22 cents of the production tax. And it's my understanding that it was put in place when the mines were having a terrible time, LCD closed down the other things. This was a way to backfill some of the revenues that were lost in the production tax. And we send out about $8 million a year in this program. And so what we're recommending here is a reduction in this program to 7 cents per ton. And our intent is to hold harmless the local jurisdictions that get this revenue. And the money that flows to the actual this, the IRR, would be, that's where the money would not be flowing to. So it's our intent under this recommendation to hold the schools, well, keep the government harmless. They'll still get the money they would get under the 22 cents. But the Doug Johnson Fund and some of the other funds where this money flows to, so it's supposed to be distributed in the same manner as the Tac Night production tax. This program, to the best of my knowledge, has never been cut. And it's the only appropriation that actually flows to the IRR, state appropriation.
Any questions on this part of the governor's budget? If not, we're going to go to a PILT adjustment. I think this is the last one that would deal with property taxes, I believe.
I believe you're correct, Chairman.
I'm sorry.
No,
Joe?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could correct. The shift in education aids also impacts several items of this budget, and it is listed on the overall.
Page 25 here.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got two more, and if you can do that in about 2 minutes, both of those, if that's possible, Commissioner.
I think we can do that. And I think the PILT payment reduction is fairly self-explanatory. We are advocating, where is it on my sheet here? Well, $4.3 million reduction in the PILT payments. 80% of the payments still go out. This represents about a 20% cut in the PILT payments. And I think this provision is actually be, well, I don't know. Maybe it isn't a tax, but I thought maybe the DNR bill might have this, but it certainly has jurisdiction here in this tax committee. So that represents about a 20% reduction in the PILT payment.
Thank you. And then the education aid payment shift on page 25.
Yes. And I think we're familiar from this from previous budget deficits, where we actually changed the K-12 recognition shift. And this is another one. I think it yields about $1.2 billion to help mitigate the budget deficit. But having said that, it also has an impact here in our levy and aid program. So you can see about $24 million for 2011 in the PPR program, because it will impact that. I don't know if there's any questions about that, but it's been a tool. I think it's fortunate that we bought back that payment shift, and it gives us a little more breathing room with the budget. And it's not ideal, but we can use the tools we have in our toolbox.
Very good.
And I think that completes the property tax provision.
Commissioner, thank you so much. And I don't know, Chairman Chesky, before we let the commissioner go, is he coming back to your tax committee, and do you have a... You'll just talk to my...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I haven't talked to the commissioner, but yes, we didn't finish today, as you know, and so we'll have more discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Chair. Look forward to working with you the rest of the session on this,
too.
Thank you. All right. At this time, we are going to give the audience opportunity. I'm sorry, Representative Garofalo, did you have a... Okay, I'm sorry. We're going to let the audience have a chance to speak, and we are going to limit you to 2 minutes. And members, I ask that you hold any questions to another day if you possibly can. We haven't heard from anyone all year yet, and so we've got about 35 minutes of testimony. So if you can kind of just line up, state your name, and we're going to really hold to the 2 minutes. So please begin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we'll be brief. I just wanted to point out, first of all, that we do take some exception with the theory that the state somehow has to protect the taxpayer from local government. As you know, county commissioners, cities, council members, school boards are locally elected. We do think that they're accountable each year when they're up for election. I just wanted to throw that out there. And also I wanted to point out that a number of things counties do are mandated. We've talked about the maintenance of effort issue. We've talked about the fact that they've been cautious to local governments when the state put their short-term offenders in our jails. So there are a number of things that we do where the state is telling us we, in fact, don't spend enough. And then on levy limits, you're saying we're not responsible to cut spending. And so I just want to point out that that's an issue for us. I also want to agree with the comments of Representative Loeffler. I think the county program made is the wrong carrot if you're trying to force consolidation in human services. I have with me Patricia Coldwell, who will talk more about that issue, but we do have a concern that in our eyes, the program aid is really about, like LGA, equalizing the ability for local governments to provide services who may have very different levels of needs or very different tax capacities. So that's, in our eyes, kind of how we see that issue. But I'll turn for the question of the 15, I'll turn it over to Patricia.
We'll start a new clock. Please begin.
Mr. Chair and members, hi, Patricia Coldwell with the Association of Minnesota Counties, work in Health and Human Services, so you probably haven't seen me as much in this committee anyway. I wanted to comment also about the proposal for the 15 regional entities for human services. We have not seen much in writing. The only thing that we've seen is the two pages or the one page that was in the management and budget overview. So it's a little difficult to comment on the specifics right now, but we have had a couple of brief conversations with the governor's office and with the Department of Human Services about what this might look like, but still lacking in some specifics. I just wanted to comment sort of from a programmatic perspective that I'm sure that you're aware that counties have done a lot of things to share services in the past. One example would be some regional adult mental health collaborative that have occurred throughout the state in the past few years. Another would be the 27, I believe it is, counties that participate in joint powers agreements for county-based health care purchasing, where they basically act as a health plan to purchase services for publicly funded, people on publicly funded health care programs. So there are histories of relatively widespread multi-county arrangements as well as some sort of macro ones as well. This, of course, would be a much more dramatic change. And I think that before we really decide, you know, how much to support this or in what form, we need more information from our members, obviously. There are a lot of advantages to sharing services and consolidation, and we have been looking at those. I think, though, that we would prefer to take an approach that's sort of a more of a form follows function than rather what may be sort of a more arbitrary topping the state up configuration kind of a thing. That's not necessarily related to either the outcomes that we might want to achieve or the more natural partnerships that might be in place because of either trade centers or relationships that currently exist or service delivery needs. What we've started to look at this in a couple of other areas, and what we try to do is to sort of focus on a principle that those services or activities that tend to be more high-touch, kind of client-focused, require integrating with community resources,
try to finish up,
et cetera. Okay, I'm done. Almost done. And others that are more high-tech, that are more administrative or technology-related, could be done on a more centralized basis. So those are some things we'll be thinking about as we move ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Barnhart. I'm speaking on behalf of North Metro Mayors right now. Two quick points. The first point is the disproportionate share of the cuts in 0304 and the proposed cuts in 09 and 10, and all I'm going to say is Representative Dietrich made the point. They were disproportionately on local government then. The proposals are now. The second point I will make is disparity. Usually when we think about disparities in the LJ program, we get into an outstate metro discussion. The point I want to make is even within the metro area, there is great disparity in both the revenue-raising ability and the need. Among cities over 2,500 in the metro area, the difference on a constant base per capita and the ability to raise revenue varies before fiscal disparities as much as 6.5 to 1. Fiscal disparities narrows up a little even after fiscal disparities. It's 5.4 to 1, the wealthiest versus the least wealthy. On the need side, although we can all argue over what is need, the LJ formula does have a measure, and in the metro area, again, using cities over 2,500, the need varies by as much as 3 to 1 on a spending base, on a per capita basis. There is a need for a robust LJ program, both on a statewide basis and in the metro area.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 13 larger counties. I just want to follow up on the comments of Mr. Matthews and Ms. Coldwell. Just provide you a little bit more detail. Again, I think the point is worth noting, although the governor gave lip service to the issue of mandate reform in his budget, it's quoted at the top of the document, summary document, that he has proposed at this time no specific relief in terms of mandates or maintenance of effort requirements. I think one thing that the committee has not become aware of to date is that the governor didn't make no changes in levy limits, but with the current rate of inflation, instead of the 3.9% that you're all anticipating is the inflation adjustment for 2010 and 2011, at this time, based on the November forecast, it will be 2.2% for 2010 and 0.9% for 2011, substantially below the 3.9%, which was already very troublesome for us. I've included the layout of the property tax aids and credit cuts for counties and the import that this human services consolidation is we have two different age levels of cuts. If we cooperate with the governor's program, the outlines of which, again, we reinforce is not available, our cuts are 25 and approximately 40 odd million less. If we don't, then they're at the higher levels indicated in the second column. I do want to particularly emphasize for the committee that we're grateful that the administration took into account in determining its property tax and AIDS credits cuts, that counties are exposed to substantial reductions in other areas of the budget. Chief among those, and this is included included in the table, that is we have to repay a $32 million one-time grant that we received in 2008. I've detailed some of the other cuts in the summary. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members. My name is Pete Peterson with Flaherty and Hood, here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'd like everyone to take a moment and remember where they were 11 years ago in 1998. To help you out, we had President Bill Clinton, we had Governor Arnie Carlson, we had two actual sitting senators in Rod Grams and Paul Wellstone. I was in my undergraduate working in mechanical engineering. Gas was $1.15 per gallon. The biggest hit in 1998 was called Too Close by Next, and if anyone can sing that song right now, they win a prize. The world had four more years till Kelly Clarkson was the first American Idol. The TV show Friends...
You only have 2 minutes.
I know, I'm getting there. The TV show Friends had six more years of new episodes. Google was two guys in a garage, and the Algae appropriation was $368 million. In 2010, 12 years later, the governor proposes that the LGA appropriation be $368 million. This alone, a cut of 31% in the base, would be enough for the state, for the Coalition of Greater Minnesotans to not support this governor's bill. But what is more important is that this bill goes beyond just a budget. It is more than just a budget for more than just for the state government to balance their budget. It is more than just our cities coping with the cuts from the budget. It is a change in policy and retreat from a policy that makes us the least supportive for this bill. In the early 70s, we started the local government aid programs and many other programs under the policy that geography in the state of Minnesota should not matter. And when we cut down on local government aid, we make disparities between the cities that can pay and the cities that can't pay, and we make disparities on businesses and residents to get the same level of services, and geography becomes more important. And that is why the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities does not support the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Patricia Nauman with Metro Cities. I don't think I can top the exciting testimony from Steve, but anyway, I'm from Metro Cities. We represent over 85 cities in the metro area before the legislature and Met Council on interest, the collective interests of metro cities. This includes the core cities, fully developed, developing, and the outer fringe. It's an understatement for me to say that we are very concerned about the level of cuts in the governor's budget to the local government aid program and the market value homestead credit program. We believe that these aids are the backbone of the state and local fiscal partnership, and that the level of cuts that the governor is taking in this budget greatly damages that partnership and that relationship. That said, we know that this is a very severe budget crisis, and it's likely to get worse, and we don't underestimate that at all. We respect greatly the work that you have ahead of you. We know it's going to be very difficult, and we want to be partners with you in that work. What we really want to look forward to is some structural reform that assures that we do not have a state revenue system that bounces up and down from year to year. As you recall, in 2003, which was the last time we had a crisis of this magnitude, we did take a significant cut to city aids, which we strongly opposed, and we just as strongly opposed the cuts that we're looking at now. We believe that pushing this crisis under the backs of cities is counterproductive to the health and vibrancy of our cities and the state. Cities provide the basic services that each one of us relies on and that provide the infrastructure that helps create jobs and grows our economy. I happened to be speaking today with the city manager for Columbia Heights as an example. He told me of their plans to cut library hours, to furlough city staff, to cut back on the police and fire department, to stop maintaining the parks at the level that they do. And this is just one example of many cities that I've heard from. Columbia Heights does happen to be a city that has an aging infrastructure, an aging population, and a relatively low tax base. Okay, I'll finish up. But we are talking about basic city services. They're not sexy or glamorous, but they are services that we all take for granted. We do look forward to working with you on longer-term structural reform. Thank you.
Ms. Snellman, and we also look forward to partner with everyone here. So that's going to be important. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mike Downing. I live in White Bear Lake. I'm not representing any organization, but I'm a taxpayer. I'm also chair of the East Metro Region of the Minnesota Senior Federation. And as such, I want to make sure that each of you are aware, as you know, I don't envy your position. You have a very, very difficult challenge ahead of you. You're pushing on a balloon, and out of it comes the taxpayer. The property taxpayer. What I would like to make sure that you're all aware of is the property tax system is way of set up right now, allowing retired seniors like myself to pay 10, 20, 30, and up to 40% of their income on property taxes. We think that's unconscionable, and we think that we ought to be doing something about it. And we're going to be working with each of you and Representative Dietrich on her working group on some benchmarks that will try to identify where those people are in the state that are paying the 10, 20, 30, and 40% of their income on property taxes. We believe it's in the metro. We believe it's older people, but we don't have the statistics, and we think that some good benchmarking would be a way of doing it. Arlo Hammerson will be coming back and testifying on some specific proposals. But as you go through your discussions, we hope that you do something about those retired seniors so we can stay in our homes in retirement. Thank you very much.
Mr. Downey, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sherwin with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and even though keeping a lawyer with a microphone to 2 minutes is a challenge, I'll do my best. I too want to follow up on Representative Dietrich's comment about the equity and fairness of the process, the fair share. To remind everybody, townships gave their fair share once before in the terms of 100% of their LGA, 100% of their HACA. It's gone. We don't have it. Now we're facing cuts in the market value credit and cuts in the TILT payment. We have townships that are 85% non-taxable property. And so when you start cutting TILT and start cutting those market credits, it gets very substantial. And so I'm very appreciative that Commissioner Innes did indicate that they recognize about a third of my members would be getting an even more disproportionate hit under the current projections, and that they plan to come back with a revised formula to try to correct that. I do appreciate that, and they had contacted our office about that fact before. It's still the truth that we've already given 100% once before, and now we're being asked to give even more, and so nothing will make it completely a fair share in that regard. Some of the other impacts that you will see is that if you cut city budgets, our service contracts Last year I told you they were doubling. This year they're tripling and quadrupling. Bottom line, contrary to what has been said, this policy does result in property tax increase. I don't have it with today to share, so I didn't realize we'd be having an opportunity to testify, but in past years, and certainly we can get it back to the committee for future reference, the property taxes at the township level have approximately doubled since the loss of the LDA payments in 2002, and that's not because townships have gone on any kind of grand spending spree. If most of you know, township halls are pretty frugal. Township officers are sometimes too cheap for their own good. So it's not like we're out there on a wild spending spree, but we've been forced to nearly double the levy, which is voter approved, in light of the policies that we've been under for the last several years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Solomon. Next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. And 2 minutes, I mean, over in education, I don't get warmed up until 2 minutes, so I'm going to have to really rip today. I represent 60 school districts in Schools for Equity and Education, both metro and non-metro. The thing that binds us together, the characteristic that binds us together, is relatively low levels of property wealth per pupil and makes our district more property tax sensitive. I really want to agree with Mr. Barnhart and what he said about the differences are not metro versus non-metro as much as they are high wealth versus low wealth. There are great differences that exist within the metro area and differences that exist in the rural areas as well and between those areas.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand local government aid and I look at the cuts to local government aid, local government aid alleviates burden within jurisdiction, but it also equalizes burden amongst and between jurisdictions. We don't know what they will be looking at next fall in terms of ballot questions for referenda. There's a number of districts that have renewals up, and any kind of change in the property tax system will certainly spill over into the could do in some of those renewal efforts. You simply can't isolate the property tax and say this isn't going to happen in this set of jurisdictions, whether they be cities, and say there's no effect on school districts, and vice versa. You can't do certain things in school districts and not change the tensions that may exist in cities and counties. So I think as we move forward, we fully understand there's an economic crisis in place. The governor has seen fit, and we thank him very much for putting forward some money into the education system. But we also know that that's only going to be part of the equation moving forward. We hope to keep those gains that the governor has put into the education bill for districts throughout the state, but we also realize there are a number of districts that will be seeking levy renewals or to increase levies through voter-approved levies in November, whether they be for debt service or for operation. And any kind of change in the property tax system has to be looked at in a way that will make those differences more palatable in terms of different levels of effort and different levels of wealth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We understand, let me start by saying we understand the magnitude of the state budget deficit, and we do respect the challenge you have ahead. We do respectfully disagree with the governor's way of balancing the budget. One plea, keep in mind that we've already made a $66 million cut in aids to cities in December. This would overlay two additional cuts before cities can implement any sort of major revenue and expenditure change or changes in their budgets for the 2010 budget cycle. So I can visit with you all more about the challenges this creates within the property tax system itself. The proposed cuts to LGA and market value homestead credit are 11% of the governor's recommended spending reductions, as I calculate it. We represent about 3% of the state budget, so that's about 3.5 times our proportionate share of the overall cut in the governor's proposed budget. Two other quick things. The market value homestead credit cuts, in addition to the LGA cuts, are somewhat problematic. From your perspective, you see a reduction in the amount of state expenditures for that program, but for a city or for a county that has the reduction in that area, they're actually losing a portion of their certified levy. And so I want you to think very long and hard about that, because the state is supposed to pay a portion of that levy as a taxpayer, and when they don't, it creates a problem. The city doesn't even get what it officially levied when it set its property tax levy. Finally, one other comment about the levy limits. I believe that the 2010 levy limits
would account for the loss of LGA, but would not account for the loss of the market value homestead credit. I think Ms. Dalton would agree with that statement. So we do have to think about the $24 million that would be lost there. For those cities, they would not have a levy limit adjustment to recoup that cost. Finally, there's a $2.5 billion deficit in the out biennium. We are very cognizant that cities are the budget reserve or a part of the budget reserve. We're very frightened to see a $2.5 billion deficit in the out biennium for fear that we could become once again subject to cuts when the 2011 legislature convenes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits and provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular emphasis on the impact of fiscal decisions on low and moderate income Minnesotans. I'm here to testify today in strong opposition to the deep cuts to the renter's credit included in the governor's budget. We think that proposal is unfair and would be a further drag on the state's economy. The renter's credit provides a reduction in property taxes to nearly 274,000 Minnesota households whose property taxes are high in relation to their income. Seniors and people with severe disabilities make up 28% of all renter's credit recipients, and the average amount of credit is about $550 a year. The governor's proposal would cut the renter's credit by 27% in fiscal year 2001 and 27% compared to base in the next biennium. That's about $51 million a year, and we think taking that $51 million fewer dollars in the hands of these low-income Minnesotans, those folks who are most likely to spend those dollars in our communities, will be a further drag on our struggling state economy. We think, as you are thinking about the renter's credit, and the chair already talked about this, that really you need to think about whether the renter's credit is being effective in reducing the regressivity of rental property taxes, which is one of our most regressive taxes. So we're very concerned about changes there. We're also concerned that low-income people, persons with disabilities, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations are being asked to play a disproportionate role in helping solve the state's budget deficit. And these are the same groups of people who would be harmed by cuts being considered in other committees, and frankly, who would be harmed by the cuts to local governments that are under discussion as well. We know that we have tough choices ahead in addressing the state budget deficit, but I feel I must add that only about half of the cuts that the governor proposes in aids and credits go to reduce the deficit. The other half goes to paying for new tax cuts that he proposes.
Ms. Madden,
yep.
You think something? Yep.
One more thing.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. The governor has brought this proposal or a similar one before at least three times in the last 4 years, and you have rejected it all of those times, and we ask you to do so again. I also have a handout, Mr. Chair, that shows the distribution of renter's credit by county.
Very good. Thank you very much, Ms. Madden.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Haugy. I'm an organizer with Homeline, which is a nonprofit tenant advocacy service that serves the entire state of Minnesota. And I'm just here today. I had some things I wanted to share in terms of the renter's credit and the people that are affected. We just found out about the governor's budget and sort of the renters. They found out how it's going to affect them. And we heard from just a few of them this past week, and I want to share some of those with you just so that you understand what Nan was talking about in terms of that the average credit is $550. Well, where does $550 go for some of these folks to get this credit in August of every year? Here's one from Lorraine and Fridley who told us that she's really concerned about the governor's cutting the renter's rebate credit refund. It's so very important to her because it helps her maintain her 92 Plymouth when she needs repairs, plates, gas, oil, and whatever other repairs come first, because a mode of transportation is pretty important for folks who have kids. We got more. An 80-year-old vet, Robert in Breckenridge, let us know that an increase in food prices recently that food stamps hasn't been covering is how that really where that goes for him. We also, Jenny in Coon Rapids wanted to share something that I unfortunately can't repeat here, but after she got done with that, she said that this goes towards her kids' school supplies and that her kids would be wearing holy clothes at school. She goes to Goodwill to get those clothes every year in August. It's a really important time of year in August to get that renter's rebate, and you're able to get clothes for the kids. Tina and Hugo, it helps get stuff for her kids, school gas. She's got children with disabilities, and helps with transportation costs going to and from the doctors. And you know, Kevin up in Moorhead said that he uses it to pay his auto insurance at that time of year. And so it's really these basic needs that people are using their renter's credit for. I think for most of everybody's district who's represented here, we have at least a story to share with you. So I'll leave those here too.
Mr. Helge, I appreciate those stories very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify? All right. Well, thank you. Well, the governor's budget is just the starting point. I mean, we have a lot of heavy lifting to do yet. So everyone in this room, around this table, is going to call on everyone in this room today and the other 5 million people around the state to help us solve this problem. So we're all in this together, and I appreciate the commissioner being here. Appreciate all the testimony. And we'll continue to work on this. Just a couple quick things. We need to pass an agenda before members go. And that would be from which date? Who's got that agenda? We have to pass the minutes. So we can have a motion to approve the January 28, 2009 minutes. Mr. Garofalo moves to approve.
I just want my name spelled right. That's all I ask. But I'll move the minutes with the correction.
All right. We will make the corrections. And with the corrections is also the move to approve and to amend. Do I hear any further discussion on that? All those in favor to approve of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion is prevailed. One other announcement before we all head off is working groups, Representative Lennon and Representative Dietrich, who chairs those, we're off and running, and great participation already. But a little bit of a timeline change for you. Remember I said something about having a bill introduced by February 26th? You now have till March 2nd. That's like about 3 more days. But at any rate, it could get you one more meeting. Here's what we're looking for schedule. March 2nd to have, that's a Monday, to have the bill introduced on that day. I talked with Representative Nelson, Representative Walski. These will go through local government, and it looks like we can get those through the week of March 9th. Monday's local government division, and 11th would be the full ops committee. And then that means it would come back to property tax division March 16th. And kind of in those next 10 days or something, we should have the time. So I think that timeline will work, so give you a few extra days to do that. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.